I'm sitting here with Lemmy of Motorhead. Lemmy, this recording from King Biscuit Flower Hour, it was recorded in 1983 at Lemours.
I have no memory of it whatsoever.
I remember taping it, and what I remember about everything was your breaking Robbo in. This was the first time playing with Brian Robertson.
Yeah, he was broke in by then. We'd done a few shows with him by then.
Uh-huh.
We were still terrified. Like,
how did you come across Brian? It skips my memory.
How did we come across him?
Yeah, how did you hook up with Brian? What was the connection again?
Well, I knew him from Thin Lizzy for years, you know. I mean, I used to meet him under tables in clubs all over London. You know, we were friends, like drinking companions for a long time. And then he was one of Phil's heroes as well, you know, because Phil's hero was Brian Downey, followed closely by Brian Robertson, followed by Phil Lynott. So when Eddie left, you know, Phil was pushing for Brian. And I didn't really have any better ideas, so I said, okay, let's go. And he came over. He was really good for a while, but then when we started making the album, he started to screw up. And then we did a tour of Europe right after that, and he was, like, all over the place. We had to cancel the tour and come back. And then we fired him.
He added a real atmospheric part.
No, he didn't. He took it away, actually. The record, yeah, but not on stage.
Yeah.
On stage, he ruined it for us.
By being too spacey?
No, by, like, being obviously not in the band, you know. He wanted to be special guest artiste, you know, and not be in Motorhead, you know, like he was slumming or something, you know. Well, you know, we fired his ass. And then Gary Bardens and State Trooper fired his ass too, which is pretty bad news. I think he's playing with Frankie Miller again now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's more or less the story. That's his problem.
That was your first record on a major label, wasn't it?
No.
It was a Polygram record, remember? The Perfect Day?
I'm not sure, but the first one we ever did on a major label was on Polygram, was No Sleep Till Hammersmith.
I remember there was a big American push at that time.
Yeah, it was on Mercury, I think.
And it was a big American push, right?
Mercury, it was a big American push.
Yeah,
sure it was, yeah.
Yeah.
People that couldn't sell Chuck Berry.
Well, they passed on Dire Straits and Jimi Hendrix, too.
Shows how much brains they got.
How did it affect the band having the change? It was the first member change.
No, it wasn't. It was the third member change.
Oh, that's right.
Because the original was Larry and Lucas.
But how did it? What was the change like when you went from Eddie to Robbo?
Well, it was like, I mean, it was just. I mean, I'd changed in a lot. I've been in a lot of bands, you know, up till then. Before Motorhead, I was in a lot of bands, and in Auckland, there's people constantly leaving and joining, you know. And I'm used to that, you know. I mean, this is one of the most settled bands I've ever been in. In 21 years, we've only had one bass player, three drummers, and five guitar players. I mean, 22 years, that ain't bad. Look at Rainbow, you know, Black Sabbath, you know.
Now, you guys had three or four records when coming over, and America got to see you for the first time. What was your impression? Ace of Spades was going...
Ace of Spades never got released until, like, 3 years after we came over here.
Well, there was...
Couldn't get arrested, you know.
Imports,
yeah, sure. But the first one was Hammersmith that got released here. Then I Infest and Another Perfect Day. And then Ace of Spades got released. It was an afterthought. Bummer and Overkill never got released for years, you know.
How do you explain that? I mean, you had a couple of number one records.
Americans had their heads up their ass, you know, about that sort of thing. In those days, they couldn't see that anything that rough. I mean, look what they did with the MC5, nothing, you know, I mean, it's a joke. Considering this is the country that invented rock and roll, it does not seem to have a prejudice against it, you know. Because this, what we do, is a logical extension of original rock and roll.
Big right? time.
We are Eddie Cochran, you know, 30 years later, you know.
It's like the original groove of Rocket Launch, the way I look at
yeah.
it.
Yeah, sure, bang, you know, wacko. Let's go out and get wrecked and fucking pull some pussy, you know. I mean, that's what rock and roll's about. I mean, there's nothing else to it. I mean, all this, I have a message for the kids, you know. Forget it, you know, people's poet. Who needs it, you know? I want to shake my ass. I want to look good for some chick and pull her and take her in a corner, you know, in the rain and screw her.
What could be better?
That's what rock and roll is truly about. I mean, I'm sorry if it doesn't fit with your personal view of things, but that's how it is. And as such, it's a wonderful invention, you know.
Amen.
Because you can't do anything like that to any other music.
So how many records does Motorhead really, truly have? Original studio records, not counting the recopied, you know, the hundreds of greatest hits and...
I think it's 20.
20?
I think so. Might be 21, though.
Yeah.
Because we had 3 years when we couldn't make an album.
Oh, yeah.
After Robbo. Before the boys, you know.
Why'd you go with two guitar players after Robbo and Eddie?
I couldn't make up my mind between them.
Oh, really? So you took them both?
Yeah. Well, Phil left the morning they auditioned anyway. So it was only me and the band for about 16 hours.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that.
And we got Pete Gill. He was good, too. He was good at the beginning.
So what's the difference between Motorhead then and Motorhead now?
Motorhead doesn't change significantly.
Yeah, it's one of those bands. It's one of those bands you can hear just 2 seconds and you know exactly what band it is.
Well, it's the vocals, isn't it? You know, but we've experimented within our genre, you know, but we haven't ever left it, which I think is the best way to go, you know. Because if you strike out too far, you've seen these people who think they should be playing jazz. They're ashamed of what they started with, which made their fame for them, you know. So they start, you know, Mark Knopfler syndrome, you know, the Carlos Santana syndrome, you know. I think it's lamentable, really. Because they go from doing something they can do very well into something they hardly understand because they think they should to progress, you know, but it's not usually progression. It's usually just out of your depth, you know.
Well, that's one thing I've always found admirable about Motorhead, the fact that it's stuck to its guns through all the years. It's changed, it's grown, it's added elements, but you've stuck to your guns.
Well, they're pretty good guns. I was stuck to the table yesterday.
I'd like to ask you about a couple of songs I like. I like Shine. I thought that song was amazing.
Yes, good song. Yeah, that was one of Brian's better moments. Another Perfect Day and Dancing on Your Grave.
Dancing on Your Grave is incredible. I noticed on the record that Another Perfect Day is Another Perfect Hangover.
Well, Brian, on the last gig he ever did with us, at the Rotation in Hanover, we finished doing Another Perfect Day and we stopped, right? And then I said, thank you, and he started it again. And I went over to him and I said, you asshole, we just did this. And he said, oh, sorry, you'd started it a third time. So, you know, we had to sort of, you know, slope it away rather sharply at that point and inform him of his tax, you know, status.
You know, Motorhead, to me, has always looked like a band that could get out of control, but hasn't really ever.
Oh, we've been out of control ever since we started.
Well, it's controlled chaos, but, I mean, nobody's died. It's still going on.
Although Brian gave it his best shot, I'll give him that. So did Phil Taylor, actually. He gave it his best shot, too. Yeah. We're going to do a book called Hospital Emergency Rooms I Visited in Europe by Phil Taylor. You know? During the last few weeks with us, he tried to climb out through his bathroom mirror in the hotel, thought it was a window. Covered in blood, you know. Like. It's pretty good, isn't it?
That's a classic. It's like a movie scene. You know, I once heard a story from Nick that made me laugh. He was describing a show you guys played where you said, let's do Bummer for an encore. And Phil supposedly said, I already played that.
I don't know. I don't remember that. That's probably apocryphal. But Mick Ralphs is largely apocryphal if you've ever seen him play.
What grade would you give Metallica for their performance of Motorhead songs at your birthday party?
Oh, 9 out of 10.
Well, I was going to ask you to give them two grades, one for costume and one for musicianship.
Costume 10, you know, except that Kirk didn't look really convinced.
Yeah.
I thought Kirk looked a bit like he wished the floor would open up and swallow him, you know, that wig on.
Lars looked like he was getting too hot. He had to bail on the wig.
He had to bail on the wig. That's understandable. James looked more like me than I do.
Yeah, he was into it.
James was bang into it, I tell you. Jimmy really believed for that few minutes. He was back in the garage, you know. That was the great thing about it.
It was a special night. How about when you played with them? How'd that feel?
Oh, fine. I played with them again at Lollapalooza, you know. Just overkill. Metallica were a very good band. When I saw them at Lollapalooza, I couldn't believe how much they'd improved, you know, since about 3 years before, since I'd seen them. I mean, I'd seen them at our gig, but like that was just a giggle, you know. Like, but when they came on and did their show, I was stunned, you know. They were unstoppable. They were brilliant. And all these people bitching and moaning about how they've cut their hair short. I mean, who fucking cares, you know? It's their hair, you know. They didn't cut their fingers off. They can still play, right? It doesn't say that your attitude changes because you want to look a bit different for a change. If you're sick of the way you've looked for 10 years, why shouldn't you change yourself? I shave my moustache off. Nobody freaks out at me because I drop them, you know. But like, nobody says... Oh, one guy did, actually. One guy said, I got a review of a Chicago show, and like the support band said, apparently, oh, sorry, we're hanging you up. I know you're waiting to see Motorhead. They must have been shouting at him. He said, like, but don't worry, Lemmy's not really the same since you shaved his moustache off, you know. And this reviewer guy said, but they were the same. They were excellent. So that shut that guy up.
I've seen about 30 Motorhead shows in my day, and I've seen a couple.
It's been a long time since the last one, though.
Yeah, well, since the whiskey. And I've seen shows where equipment blew up and things were bad, but I never really saw a stinker, you know, a show where I felt I got ripped off.
We have very few stinkers. We never ripped anybody off. Never. The only time when we might have been accused of that was when we were doing short shows on Phil Taylor's last days, because he was unbearable to play with, you know, like his timing had gone. And he obviously didn't care, you know, and you couldn't communicate with him anymore. And like, also with Brian to an extent, that. But all the same, we still never turned in a stinker, you're right. We turned in shows that were bad as far as we were concerned, but you wouldn't have noticed much.
The show that's on this record, I can actually hear you taking the audience on, asking people why they're leaving, how come they're not paying more attention.
Yeah. Well, it's like Brian wasn't Eddie and they couldn't stand it, you know.
Yeah. That took long to adjust to. I mean, I don't think it really ever clicked as good as, you know, when...
He never adjusted. People never adjusted. He was gone in 18 months, you know. But yeah. Like, we came back at Hammersmith on May the 7th, 1984, and we murdered him.
Right.
With the two guitar players and Pete Gill. Man, we killed him. And I remember saying, well then, are we back or what? And the house, they all stood up. They just stood up with their hands in the air, you know, it was great. But America never really gave Motorhead a chance anyway from the word go. They didn't give us a chance with Eddie, no mind without him, you know, and they didn't give us a chance. We've been around too long for one. We'd been around so long already when we first came here, you know. We were that name that was in the background all the time. People are used to not being able to buy our records, so they don't go out to try, you know. And we're never going to get radio play.
You know, I had high hopes when you guys did the Aussie tour. I thought so many people would see you and the word would spread.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I thought we'd do all right with Slayer that time, too.
What I see lying on the coffee table, or next to the coffee table, really reminds me of Chapter 7 of your book. I mean, you have to write a book. That I don't think there's anybody who needs to tell a story more than you do.
Yeah, well, as you can see, it's only the bare bones. You know, I've got to put some guts behind it, some viscera. In there, but like, it's on its way, yeah.
You know, if there's one thing about Motorhead that I enjoy, I mean, the music's hard, heavy, but there's always been a sense of humor.
Oh, yeah.
As heavy, as nasty as it can be, there's always been the lighter side that keeps...
Well, the sense of humor's pretty nasty, too.
Yeah. Well, that's the real fun. You know, it's that's what I noticed about the book. Do you have any idea when you'll finish it or when it'll be published?
Yeah, we got interest in it from a few publishers, you know, especially in England. So I don't know what we'll happen. We do what we can, you know. Like on the new album, that Them Not Me, you know. Did you see the accident? The road is red with blood. Funny how it makes you feel really, really good. It was them, it wasn't me, you know. It's a very English sense of humor.
Yeah.
Very, very, very black, you know. But then we like that in England. We like a road accident, you know. I mean, you do over here, but you feel guilty about it. In England, we love it. We slow down, get out of the car, you know, take a picnic, you know. Get the kids, hey, look at that, the head over there. You know?
Son, that's your first accident.
Yeah, right. Don't kick the head around, leave it. You know.
It reads very much like you talk, the book. I mean, the chapter that's sitting there, I mean, I feel like I'm listening to Lemmy talking and going on telling stories.
Right, well, that's the idea.
How would you describe this record that you recorded at L'Amour's?
An uphill struggle.
Yeah.
I should think. I don't even remember how it sounds. Does it sound good?
It's very atmospheric.
Lucky, lucky, lucky. Well, atmospheric, you mean it's out of tune.
Yeah.
Usually the translation of that one.
No, it's heavy. You know, you've got some real stuff on it. Listen to me telling you what songs are...
No, I don't remember what the set was. Brian wouldn't play Overkill and Motorhead and all them numbers, you know.
He couldn't get out of playing Ace of Spades, could he?
Yeah, he wouldn't do that either.
Did he try to talk you into doing any of his songs?
No. Which I suppose is fair enough.
So what do you listen to these days?
The two Skews, Skunk Anansie and Skew Siskin.
Yeah, are you still writing with Skew Siskin?
Yeah.
Because you used to write songs with him.
Yeah, I wrote a lot on the new album.
I never heard any of those.
Very good, they are. I'll play them for you in a minute.
Do you have any plans, I mean, other than to just continue what you're doing?
Well, it's a full-time job, you know. I mean, there isn't a lot of leisure time. As you can see by this apartment, I mean, it'd be tidy if I spent all my time here, but I'm 8 months in the bus, you know.
Yeah.
And 4 months here, 3 months of which is in the studio, so I'm at my apartment about a month out of a year, you know. So although it's a mess, it's my mess, you know, and I quite like it.
It's quite nice. Would you change anything in your life going back? It looks like you're pretty much doing what you wanted to.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I would have been more famous, but there again, we would probably have broke up if we were. Because bands would get it all on a plate, you know, always self-destruct. I think that's been a sort of backhanded favour in a way, that we never got a huge amount of money because it kept us hungry, you know.
Yeah, I felt that way about Thin Lizzy, because they never quite made it. They were always trying to kick everyone's butt.
Well, they were huge in England, but like...
Well, so are you. I mean, how can you not be huge when you have number one records?
Oh, well, we were huge for, you know, that's, what, 3-4 records. Yeah. And we were climbing up with Overkill was, what, number 28 or something, and then Bomber was number 12, and then Ace of Spades was number 6. Or number 4 or something. It went straight at number 4. So we knew Hammersmith because they've been waiting for a live album for years.
Well, yeah, well, that's the kind of band you are.
They went straight in at number 1.
I heard that record. It blew my mind.
Well, yeah, but the thing is you can't follow it. You can't do another live album. Yeah. And you can't follow it with a studio album. It's like you cut your nose off and you spite your face.
If you make the best live record you can for that year of the band, you can't touch it.
Right.
You can't do it again.
Yeah, but we didn't want to do it again, but you can't follow it with a studio album, you see, because it's a live album. And that's the excitement of it, you know. And on top of that, which we followed it with a substandard album. Iron Fist wasn't as good as any of the 4 that were before it, you know.
How much can you see of your influence on today's hard rock metal?
Very little.
You think so?
Yeah, I don't hear it much. Metallica, I used to be able to hear it, not anymore. They're their own men now. But like, really, you don't hear influences, you know. I'm influenced by the Everly Brothers and the Beatles. You don't hear it in Motorhead.
I'm hearing more and more Chuck Berry on your last few records.
Well, or Little Richard, you know.
Yeah, it's coming back to me now.
Yeah, that's my roots, it's not Phil's. I mean, if you hear a lot of Todd Rundgren on the next record, you'll know why. He named his first son Todd Rundgren Campbell.
Oh boy. Do you have any trouble keeping this all together? I mean, it's been a shaky boat in a lot of ways.
Why? When?
Well, I mean, just people coming in, coming out.
As long as the captain's on the bridge.
That's what I'm getting at.
It's all right, you know. I mean, I never even considered that it was a shaky boat. It's not a shaky boat. You know, you can always...
Maybe that's just an appearance.
Not really, no. It's not like that. I can see where you would see that, but it's not like that. It's definitely a democracy as far as the music goes, you know.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Mickey and Phil wrote half of the last album, the riffs all by themselves. I just come in and mess with them, you know. I just come in and go, don't like that, let's make this bit a bit longer or something like that, you know. And I come in with my songs and they screw with them too, you know. But it doesn't go out until all three of us are happy with it, you know, which is the point. I mean, if it was just me, I'd say, oh, that's fine, boys, you know. Go and sit down, but it's not like that. I can't stand bands like that anyway.
Well, in bands where one guy runs everything and the other guys don't have a say, I bet that doesn't feel good either.
You can tell too.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a band.
Deep-seated resentment, humiliation, and hatred.
I've always thought bands were like, you know, you're doing something that's really hard to do and it's a very dangerous way to make a living. So you might as well be...
You might as well be friends.
Yeah, you might as well be friends and be your own little gang or army that's against the world.
Because it's going to be you against the world, man, because the world is certainly against you, you know, especially these days, my God. They're blaming rock and roll for everything, aren't they? Cancer, you know, the space shuttle. everything is rock and roll's fault. I mean, that's how good the government is. They can't stand up and make mistakes. and say, sorry, we'll try it another way. Like a government should be able to, a good one. And don't forget, boys and girls, a two-party state is only one party better than a one-party state. Especially if they wear the same clothes and say the same shit.
In closing, I'd like to ask you one more thing.
Oh.
I once said to you that I thought Motorhead was one of the few truly original bands I've ever heard in this genre of music. That when they first came along, I really couldn't tell where it came from. It was complete. It was just like getting hit by a laser on the side of the head. I was in shock.
Good.
And I felt the same way when I heard Metallica. I felt the same way when I heard Black Sabbath. I felt the same way with
MC5,
Deep Purple. There are certain bands, the first time you hear them, they just kill you.
Yeah, because you're not prepared, yeah.
And you're not prepared because it's so dangerous and so exciting, it makes you want to hear more and more.
Well, that's the idea. That's the point. That's rock and roll.
I mean,
you can't have safe rock and roll. That's not the nature of the beast, you know. I mean, rock and roll has got to make your children do strange things that you never would have done yourself. That's the point.
It's got to be over the top, huh?
Yeah. You know, what else is it for? We are the ones you can blame for everything, right? You can blame me. It's my fault. And good luck with it.